This is Defender Radio.
I'm Michael Howie, and this is Defender Radio, the podcast for wildlife advocates and animal lovers, brought to you by the Fur Bearers. Making an emotional connection to a non-human animal is a defining moment in many people's lives. It could be the family dog, a squirrel who hops past a window every day, or a black bear known to meander through a local forest. It's that connection that can help people understand the depth of non-human animal emotion and make changes in how they view the world around them. Dr. Mark Beckoff knows a thing or two about this connection and has revisited a classic publication to show how far science and society have come in understanding animal emotions. Dr. Beckoff is a celebrated ethologist, best-selling author, professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado, and along with Dr. Jane Goodall, a co-founder of Ethical Treatment of Animals, Citizens for Responsible Animal Behavior Studies. His popular book, The Emotional Lives of Animals, was originally published in 2007 to great response. 17 years later, Dr. Beckoff has updated and revised the book with new studies, anecdotes, an updated foreword from Dr. Jane Goodall, and more. Dr. Beckoff joins Defender Radio to share what he's most excited about in the newly revised book, if recognition of animal sentience is the finish line for advocates, and where he sees hope for the future. At the time, and I know you broach this in the book, but at the time, would you have imagined the praise, and just for context, the praise comes from doctors Jessica Pierce, Jane Goodall, Peter Singer, Dr. Ian Dunbar, Ingrid Newkirk, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, pretty much the who's who of ethics and animals and the environment. So all of that praise, all of the sales, and a demand for a revised edition. Could you have foreseen that 14 years ago, do you think?
When I wrote the first edition, I was really pleased with it. It had a good reception. I'm a scientist. And while some people questioned some of my views, and across the board, no one's really questioned my science, which is, I like that, you know, because I'm not trying to fib my way into creating stories or, you know, creating stories from scientific research about what we know and don't know. I think I'm very fair on that. I never really thought about it. And then my publisher, New World Library, with whom I've done a number of books, I think it could be 2 years ago, my editor, Jason Gardner, told me that through publishing circles, you know, there was noise being made that I should write a second edition of a book. And many of my colleagues who have done it before said, don't do it because it'll be more work than the first edition. And I kind of laughed it off. And I was really involved in doing books. So I said, I actually just said, no, you know, I'm really not interested now. But then I kept thinking about it and thinking about it. And then maybe a year and a half ago, Jason Gardner, my editor, asked me again, and I said, yeah, I'll do it. And the rules in the United States is for a second edition or for a book to be called a second edition, it only has to be modified 20%.
Oh.
And so, you know, it could be a combination of cutting material, adding new material, adding references. I didn't even use that as a guideline because the new edition of The Emotional Lives of Animals is far longer than we thought it would be. And I probably added 300 references. Mm-hmm. And to be honest with you, it was a lot of work. There were a few times when I just wanted to just say, it's obvious that elephants grieve. It's obvious that dogs enjoy playing. You know, it's obvious that compassionate conservation is the key to the future. But it just kept me going. And in all honesty, I'm really glad I did it. And I really like it. And so do people who have, you know, read it. It's a vastly different book in the sense of, I think, being a much stronger call to action. You know, a much stronger call to using what we know and have known for since Darwin, at least, maybe since Plato and Aristotle, that we need to treat non-human animals better.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm glad that I resisted those evenings where I was sitting there, shut my computer off, and had already written a note to my editor saying, you know, this sounded like a good idea 18 months ago, but it ain't going to fly. I'm really happy with the book, and I hope people are too.
Yeah, well, I, for one, greatly enjoyed reading it. I got my digital copy for reviewing, and I am going to be going out to get my print copy at some point. And I absolutely loved reading it. And I agree, I always enjoy in your writing, you're very honest about science. And there's no ivory tower, there's no academia really pushing through. It's, hey, there's a study that says this. That means that X plus Y equals Z. So from that, we can take this. And it's just, okay, thank you. I don't need to go read a 2,000-page biology book to understand the point that's being made. And I agree. I love flipping to the back of it, too, and seeing, all right, so we've got the index, we've got the end notes, and we've got the references. You have three separate reference sections in the book, which has been a trend for you lately. That for someone like me, who is very much sort of a surface level, I learn a little bit about a lot of things. I really enjoy that because when I need to find something, I can quickly locate it in the book. Whereas, I've got my sound tents up, but I've got a dozen reference books. I could spend 3 hours trying to find the right sentence in it. Whenever it's your stuff, I can jump right to it. So I appreciate that. And speaking of the science,
thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh no, I was going to thank you for that. My my editors and publishers are very, very, I don't want to say careful about that. Full. It's kind of like full disclosure, you know, references and notes and index. Because what bothers me, and I know that it's often comes down to, you know, cost and, you know, a lot of books that are being written today really sell, not because they're not good, but fewer people seem to be reading. But a good index is really critical. I get, like you, I get so frustrated when I pick up a book, I just want to see what's covered. And then I read it or take notes in certain sections. And then I'll go, well, what about this topic? And there's no index. And you know, the cross-referencing is critical. Or to find out, you know, one of the guides I use, and I don't think I'm alone in doing this, although some people would admit it, but sometimes when I read a book that's not mine, I look at how they covered my work. It's not a question of whether I'm in the book. It's more, I know I'm there. I want to see how they cover it. And I use that as a guide for the way in which authors cover material with which I'm not that intimately familiar and things. So no, I think it's important. Of course, it's also laborious. So what I learned, and if there's any budding authors listening, is as you're writing the book, keep your separate note and reference section as you're writing. So maybe, you know, after a couple of hours, you go back and fill it in. Don't wait till the end. I've done that. And in one book I did with Jessica Pierce, so there were two of us. I remember she'd say, well, what about this? I say, I'll do it later. You know, so, and then when later comes, you go, oh, my goodness. But anyway, I appreciate your comments there because I really, I'm happy to be a scientist. I'm happy to give out all the, you know, the credit to where credit's due. But I think that the most important thing is cashing it out so that people in rural Winnipeg or rural Kansas can read it and have faith that you're covering the science, you know, from which you're separating your ideas, especially how we should treat non-humans, that you're doing it fairly. So that, once again, the fact that people having criticized my science means a lot to me. And also looking at stories, because all my books have stories from people who email me all the time, is getting them right. So what I usually do is just copy from email, paste them in. And then if there's, you know, little typos, you can correct them. I actually spent an hour finding out whether that's permissible. And so I would ask people, but legally it's permissible if you make changes, but not changes in meaning.
Yeah. You know?
But anyway, you know, and there's a whole lot of new, there's a whole section in there on compassionate conservation that wasn't in the early edition, although I was writing around the issues. So yeah, I'm happy with it.
Excellent. Well, and you write about the science itself early on and say, science is still trying to catch up to what people experience in animal emotions daily. And you write that as a positive. And I'm curious, could you explain why it's good news that we don't have all of the science yet, or that we're seeing science emerge regularly still related to animal emotions broadly?
Right. I mean, I make that comment, and I've been making it for a really long time. A lot of it just stems from my work on dogs. When I'll go to a local dog park where I spent a lot of time when I was writing dog books, and I would talk to people, and they'd go, you know, geez, you academics just beat the hell out of everything. And, you know, we know this about dogs, for example, they'll say that. So, you know, my attitude is, yeah, we know it, but isn't it nice to really know it with in more detail, for example, you know, and so that's why I think it's important to get it right. And I actually have learned that people who are really serious about, say, living with a dog, or serious about conservation of wild animals, are pretty well read. You know, they're opinions that would differ from mine and from yours, but they're pretty well read. So they're expecting you, you know, if you will, as an expert in the field, whether you're a scientist or some other sort of academic, to get it right. And I've actually had a few people with dogs, and actually some stuff with wolves and coyotes not too long ago, said, well, God, we read that paper, or we read that book, and we got a different picture. Why? And just by talking with them, I could understand why people, my scientific background, might look at their data differently. You know, in the end, we do the trains meet, if you will. But I really love when people push me, you know, and ask for more details or more clarification.
Yeah. I'm curious, this is a question I had written out. In many of your examples, you speak about engaging with individuals. So this is in the book, in conversation with you, and in other writings. You will talk a lot about how you engage with folks, and it can be during a lecture to a couple of hundred researchers, or one-on-one with someone at a conference or a dog park. I personally can find it more straightforward to talk with someone about these issues and provide a thoughtful conversation. So when it's one-on-one, someone's genuinely curious, I find that conversation can go pretty well. But when we switch over to social media, traditional media, and trying to get to these big audiences, a lot of that conversation seems to go out the window. In this era we're in of digital communication, where we're in some ways further apart than we were before, how do we take these experiences if you've had and this mastery of the conversation you've had, and maybe try and apply it to those digital ways, or can we?
Well, it's a great question. Once again, like working with dogs, and I hate to say it this way, but I think most people would agree, there's a lot of good stuff out there and there's a lot of junk out there. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because everybody thinks they can write a book on dogs, and it's like everybody thinks they can write a kid's book on their kid or something like that. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the reasons I write for Psychology Today as much as I do is because they edit it. And every now and again, I'll write something and they'll come back and say, well, we didn't quite look at it that way. You know, there's some editing there in the sense of making sure that what you're saying is really clear and to the point. So, but I love that question because it's just very hard because things in social media, on social media, can just spread like wildfire. Mm-hmm. And I actually had that happen to me a few years ago where, so for example, I write in the Emotional Lives of Animals, both editions, about animals behaving as if they are having virtual experiences. Yeah. And the big thing is they are as if. It's not like saying animals are acting as if they like to play. They do like to play. I don't have to use as if they like to play.
Yeah.
But, you know, are animals, do animals experience spiritual lives or some degrees of spirituality? And I mentioned Jane Goodall's waterfall dances. And this, and in fact, just in the last year or two, there's just been a lot more coming out on that. So I'm not on social media. I'm on Twitter, or I guess it's called X now, mainly for sending material out to people who don't have access to it. But then one day I got an email from somebody that said, so you believe that dogs and other animals have ESP, extrasensory perception. Well, my answer is I don't know. Yeah. But that's completely different from saying you believe it. And they were referring to Rupert Sheldrake's work. He wrote a book, Dogs Who Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. Yeah. You know, and they'd start, you know, running around the house when their human was 10 kilometers away or something like that. My only response is that nothing's lost by keeping the door open. Mm-hmm. But no, I did not make an explicit statement that dogs have ESP. And yeah. The reason I say that is because this person who wrote to me went on and on and on. It was like, oh, my goodness gracious, they must have something better to do. Saying, well, if you believe that, why should we believe your research and the research you write about? Yeah. So I don't answer emails like that, but I did answer them. And the only thing I wrote back was, you should believe me. I'm a pretty good scientist, and I never heard back from them. but you know how it spread.
Yeah.
So I say this to a lot of people, and I'm glad there's a lot of other authors who write books on, say, animal cognition and animal emotions and animal moral behavior for the masses. And one such person who did it masterfully is Frommel, who passed away a couple of weeks ago. And whether you agree with what he writes is not relevant. He covers the science in a very scholarly and accessible way, you know, and actually Jane Goodall, when she writes and goes to the science, she is a scientist, by the way. I mean, she has a PhD from Cambridge.
It's funny how people forget that sometimes.
Yeah, no, and it's not because she's a good friend. She's a good scientist. She knows this stuff. I talked to her a lot about it. But, you know, her book, The Chimpanzees of Gombe, that was written 38 years ago, something like that, 1986, is totally science-based, as are some of the things she's writing now about protecting chimpanzees in captivity, cetaceans, and, you know, other animals. So the reason I mentioned that, you can do it all, you can reach the masses, but it takes a little more time to boil down a t-test, or what does P less than 0.05 mean, or something like that. Yeah.
So it's maybe a slow rollout in terms of how we're able to get the ideas across. And speaking of that, you mentioned one already, in a sense, is sentience. And you write a lot about this. And I don't want to get too deep into it because it's a large amount of the book and various other writings you've done. But I, rather than discuss if sentience is real and whatnot, is sentience the finish line for animal protection? When I was reading it, that's the question that kept popping into my head of, we constantly talk about sentience. If we can prove animals are sentient, And I think a great example of it, of why this question came into my head, is the example of what's happened in Spain, where animals, non-human animals, were declared to be sentient. And on one hand, you think, well, we did it. We're done. Spain is now a safe place for non-human animals. But the reality is it's not. Bullfights still go on. No. There's various other issues. Meat consumption is still there. While we think about sentience as this sort of objective, do we see it or should we see it in terms of protection as a finish line? Or is it another thing to add to the pile of evidence?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, because New Zealand, there's this ongoing war on wildlife, you know, basically torturing, poisoning, trapping, shooting, invasive species, for example. Yep. Invasive, by the way, because they came in via humans. I mean, they had animals as sentient beings as well. But yet, the war on wildlife is the most brutal on the planet. The way I look at it is sentient means the ability to feel. Very simple. You know, academics could beat it to death so that after 5 minutes, you have no idea what they're talking about. Or people can beat it to death and define it in a way that it only applies to human animals, which people have done, by the way. So sentience refers to feelings. And for me, and I love your question, it's one criterion among others that call for protecting the life of every individual. And it's one of the bases for compassionate conservation. Mm-hmm. It's one of the bases for what Jessica Pierce and I call the science of animal well-being rather than the science of animal welfare. And we wrote about that in a book called The Animal Agenda. My take on it, and you could still see it in compassion conservation and in other disciplines, is that sentience is important. But I go further and just say, an individual is alive, that'll mean something, sentient or not. So one has to be careful. You know, when people used to write off, quote, lower mammals like amphibians and reptiles, they weren't smart, they weren't emotional, they weren't sentient. Yeah, they are, but they're all three and more. So I do like your question, because it is. But I think we need to go further, because number one, we're expanding what I call the biodiversity of sentience, the arena, the sentience club, if you will. And number two, you know, a lot of animals who we might, like some insects who we might think don't really aren't, which is now proving not to be the case in a lot of insects. Don't really care if they live. And yes, they do. They've evolved anti-predatory mechanisms, for example. I call them life-preserving mechanisms. And then the real skeptic could say, well, they're always hardwired. Now we're learning so much about bees and ants and other animals, their amazing learning capacities. And observational learning, just recently, a study of observational learning bees. So my take is, nothing's lost by keeping the door open for animals for whom we don't have, if you will, convincing or solid scientific data.
Well, and I think that leads nicely into the idea of compassionate conservation. This is something you've written about, you and I have spoken about. Mm-hmm. There seems to still be a gap in terms of getting that message out to the general public. And I'm wondering if you could sort of share that high-level view of compassionate conservation and how it differs and why that matters from our traditional views. And for those playing at home, the model that we very much follow is the North America model of wildlife conservation, which is an excuse to keep killing them. If you could, back to the question, sort of the high level overview, and what is the difference and why is that important?
Yeah, I sometimes say that the North American model, I think there was a James Bond movie called License to Kill. And that's what I look at it. Yeah, well, once again, that's a really, really good question. So compassionate, a lot of the roots of compassion were laid 30, 40 years ago. Dale Jameson and I wrote a paper called Reflective Ethology, Doing Science While Respecting Animals. And we didn't have the phrase compassionate conservation. But once again, it comes back to valuing the life of each and every individual. The base tenets for compassionate conservation are first, do no harm, and the life of every individual matters. And, you know, we should be striving for coexistence. You know, those are all basic foundational guidelines for compassionate conservation. So I'm very open to say that some of the critics of compassionate conservation, to me, and I know people will probably get up, some people will get upset, they haven't really read what compassionate conservation is all about. I mean, early on, a group of us established that compassionate conservation puts non-killing, non-lethal methods at the table for discussion. Some of us go further and say that killing's off the table. And when killing's off the table, a lot of people doing conservation are very bright people, and they'll come up with non-lethal protocols and solutions to the problem, to the problems at hand. So that focus really means that we can no longer play what a lot of conservationists play, called the numbers game. There's 10 million brown rats, so it's okay to kill 1,000 of them, you know, and because they're working on what we call collective species or populations, not individuals. And so compassionate conservation, with its focus on the life of each and every individual, is a challenge to some people, you know, because they'll say, well, you know, how would you like it if they said there's lots of people like Mike Howie or Mark Beckoff, so we're going to get rid of you. I mean, that's what it comes down to, you know, and I often bring it home by saying, would you do it to your dog? And it's a conversation stop. Or maybe it's a comma, not a full stop period, because people will say, well, why are you asking? Well, because there's tons of golden retrievers and beagles and purebred dogs and some Labradoodle hybrids. So somebody might come to your house and say, you know, there's a shortage of dog food or a shortage of something, and there's too many golden retrievers in the world, so we're going to kill yours. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And so when people go, you know, some people get upset, but when people say, well, why are you asking that question? My answer is a very simple one. I'm just saying that, well, these dogs are sentient beings, just like wolves and bears and whales and dolphins and great apes and other non-human primates and mice and rats and fishes and reptiles, amphibians, et cetera. And for the ones who are open to a discussion, whether they agree with me or not, we generally go into a good space. You know, a lot of people just go, well, compassionate conservation, I mean, I've had people, and it's it's too elitist, it's too feminine, it's too touchy feeling. Well, it's none of those. I mean, if being compassionate to animals and wanting to kill them is feminine, bring it on. But or elitist. Yeah. And one criticism that was published in a paper really is that it was elitist. And gosh, if you look around the world at different countries who are having successful compassionate conservation campaigns, they're hardly rich, wealthy, elitist countries. My take, and I do mean this. I mean, and I've written it, so I don't feel like saying anything that I haven't said before, is I think a lot of the people who criticize compassionate conservation haven't really read the details, because climate conservation is all for maintaining and increasing biodiversity. And that's one criticism somebody made is, oh, well, you're all just wrapped up in this touchy-feely compassion and ignoring biodiversity. Wrong.
Yeah. And that's it's interesting, too, because even the having new ideas is part of creating biodiversity, right? That's the principle in play. But I suppose we do need something in this conversation that proves the patriarchy is in place when we talk about conservation. And we have now checked that box.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, I know a lot of people who were foundational in, say, forming the discipline of compassionate conservation, and those who are practicing it. And one of the heartening things to me is I get emails from grad students, postdocs, people who have been studying a particular problem for a really long time saying, we don't want to continue using, say, lethal, inhumane methods to solve, hopefully solve conservation problems. So that's really good. The other thing that comes out of it, and a lot of people don't really realize it, is that a lot of study techniques and conservation methods result in high stress for animals, So really what people are doing is they're reporting about the behavior of stressed animals. So I've actually said, well, in some studies where they say, well, the animals do this and we could conserve or preserve them this way, I'll say, well, those were stressed animals. And a woman named Gisela Kaplan in Australia has been writing a lot about research methodology and its effect on bird behavior, for example.
Interesting.
They're studying stressed animals. So they're seeing things that you would not expect to have seen in non-stressed animals for different behavior patterns to evolve, for example.
And it may have even been in one of your books or papers that I read many years ago, but talking about we stopped studying animals in captivity because we recognize that animals in captivity do not act like animals in the wild.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, some do, of course, because there's a whole, panoply of different spectrum, if you will, of individual differences within species. But you're exactly right. And I made the same comment a number of times for studies of dogs in labs.
Yeah.
And I really want to be clear here, and no one's really come at me, but in my book, Dogs Demystified, I wrote very clearly, and I spent a lot of time, phrasing it, is that the reason that studies of dogs in laboratories, but you could extend it to other animals, the reason their results often differ, it's not because the science is bad. They're studying different dogs in different situations, in different contexts, using different methodologies.
Yeah.
And I think, we see that in studies of wild animals. You can study wolves in Yellowstone, or people are studying wolves in wolf sanctuaries. And yeah, there's some overlap, but it's not a criticism of the science or the scientists. It's basically saying we need to learn more about how individuals of different species adapt to different, ecological and environmental or social conditions. I think it's taking off. I really do. And I think it's a challenge to people because it also means that we're not going to solve some of these problems overnight.
Yeah.
It took a long time for the most invasive species on the planet, by the way, humans, to wreak havoc on the lives of so many individuals of so many species. So we did it. Okay. It's sort of a criticism of Homo sapiens, but this is where we're at, Mike.
Yeah.
You know it. I mean, you do this work too, this is where we're at. So the best conservation, the best ecological studies are going to come from animals who are, if you will, unstressed or not increasingly stressed by the research protocols or conservation protocols that are being used. And are we going to get quick and dirty answers? Well, I hope not, because those quick and dirty answers have resulted in the decimation of habitats and really the killing off of countless non-human animals, sentient or not, if you will.
And it's an interesting point to mention when we're talking about the compassionate conservation. I recently read a paper and did a very quick write-up on it from Frontiers in Veterinary Science called Health and Environmental Effects to Wildlife from Radio Telemetry and Tracking Devices.
I just saw that paper last week.
Yeah, it's very interesting. They rely a lot on their own research related to VHF and UHF and the electromagnetic field, which is not something I only know a little bit about from when I had to write about that for cell towers many, many years ago. But one of the things, they ask a lot of great questions in this paper about the impacts, but they don't necessarily get into exactly what you just brought up is the, and this is why we at the Fur Bears were excited for this study, was, well, what impact does just having the collar put on an animal have over time? Is that animal going to act the same way? Are they going, like, if you're itchy every minute of every day because you've got something on your neck and you have to scratch it constantly? It's maybe not significant long term, but it is a change in behavior. If you have to trap a coyote in a leg hold before you can put the collar on or do a health assessment, what impact does that have on them emotionally long term? Questions like that. And it's great to see the questions are being asked. We may not have the answers, but the questions are being asked. And that's where it starts.
Well, there's been some reviews of that. And somebody recently asked me, and I don't know if anybody's recently compiled it, but in my Encyclopedia of Animal Behavior, which was published 20 years ago, which is a frightening thought because I remember working on it and regretting a lot of it because it was such a pain to do. But I actually wrote a summary article in there, and I'm sure people are working on it. And I'm sure Gisela Kaplan in Australia would know more. But there has been work. You know, the first, a lot of the early research was done on diving behavior in penguins with backpacks on, and it changed their behavior. And it was from that research that the concept of the instrument effect emerged. And other people, Tim Cairo has studied, I think it was hyenas or cheetah, looking at how the weight of a collar above a certain percentage of the weight of the individual can change their behavior. So people, you know, and then there was that work by Marlene Zuck on zebra finches that showed that the color of the leg bands that people use to identify the birds could actually change their mating patterns.
Really?
So I think it's in this edition. It's certainly in the first edition. So, yeah, I mean, this is a really useful discussion. And you're right. I mean, you know, you trap, you know, if you do, you use a trap or a snare that causes harm, and then you release the animal and they're tagged. Well, yeah, the tag might change their behavior. But the fact of the matter is, if they avoid the area in which they're trapped, they should get the Albert Einstein IQ award because they're going, I had a horrible experience there. But the reason I'm mentioning this is that's also coming out in a lot of emails I get from people saying, how can I mark the animals without changing their behavior or changing the social interactions they have with other individuals?
Yeah.
You know, So that kind of awareness, and, you know, some people go, oh, gee, of course. Well, you know, it's not an oh, gee, of course. You know, there might be some techniques, as long as they're not harming the individuals physically or emotionally, that are used that might be okay. The bottom line, of course, is you need to know that.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of things that even just jump into my brain trying to think about it, You think of military technology where they use infrared for tagging things for long distance. Mm-hmm. You think, oh, that could
right.
work. Wait a second. How many animals and insects can see the infrared spectrum?
No. Exactly.
Right. And just all of a sudden you start adding these variables and go, oh yeah, that won't work. And that wouldn't work either. But asking the questions. I have two left on that note. One is on rewilding, which is a subject I love. Yep. It's a subject you've written about and we've spoken about. And I wanted to ask, and I'm asking it the specific way because it comes up a lot. Sure. Does rewilding mean introducing timberwolves to Toronto or black bears to New York City? Using the ad absurdum argument that we tend to get, or the slippery slope.
Well, I mean, it could.
Yeah.
We just brought wolves back to Colorado. So people talk about reintroduction projects, and I kind of like the word repatriation because none of these wolves used to live here before.
Yeah.
You know, if I was born in New York, so if I went back to New York, you could say that Mark is being reintroduced to New York because I lived there for, 15 years. But it is part of rewilding. There's a lot of positive and quote negative aspects to it. For example, the wolves ten wolves were reintroduced or repatriated to Colorado in December, and they've never lived here. And the last wolves who were here was something like 94 or 95 years ago. So the ecosystems have evolved.
Yeah.
So we're not putting wolves back into areas that resemble even closely the areas from which they were taken and killed. The other was people were making comparisons between the Colorado Project and the highly successful Yellowstone Project.
Yes.
Well, Yellowstone's a national park, so people didn't have to worry about whether the wolves would be killed in the park, although I'm sure some were. But, once again, it's a very different situation. So that could be rewilding. But the situation into which the wolves were placed in Yellowstone or in Colorado were vastly different from the situations from in which they were killed.
Yeah. Well, and my understanding with a lot of rewilding as well is that we're looking for opportunities, and it's not kickstarting ecosystems, because I don't think you do that from the top down, but it's sort of where can we start returning slowly? And as you said earlier, it was a long process to remove all of these animals from the landscape. We're not going to throw a switch and all of a sudden airdrop raccoons into Quebec City or anything, which right. I would actually see that movie if we did do it, though. With French subtitles and everything for the raccoons, it would be great. But I do find it interesting that, folks, I struggle sometimes say, well, we're talking about mini forests. We're talking about habitat connectivity in patches and really low level rewilding, so that we can get to the point where if we are reintroducing wolves to Colorado, the areas around them will support them as well. Or if we're reintroducing bears somewhere, the resources that they need will exist and be functional on their own.
Absolutely. I mean, one little thing it's not little, but, one fact that a lot of people don't know unless they live here or they've read. So these wolves who were reintroduced in Colorado are protected. They can't be just shot. Mm-hmm. If they cross the border into Wyoming, they can be shot.
Yep.
It's legal. And there's evidence that some wolves who crossed the border in the northwest part of Colorado into Wyoming were lured into Wyoming to be shot.
Jeez.
Killed.
Yeah.
So, but I think your question is such a good one that number one, the changes say to the ecosystem, the integrity of or connectivity of the ecosystem are not going to occur overnight.
Yeah.
I mean, because that's what I meant by saying ecosystems evolve absent the presence of primary, top predators like wolves, coyotes, bears, and other animals you know, like that. So people need to be patient. You know, it's really interesting, both personally and kind of scientifically for me, because I've always questioned these projects because, number one, like you're taking, like in this case of Colorado, you're taking wolves from Oregon, you're moving them to Colorado, you're wolf-napping them, you're breaking up families there. There's ethical questions.
Of course.
Okay. You bring them here and you're subjecting elk, you know, elk and moose and deer and other ungulates and maybe some, you know, I hate the word livestock, but food animals to their presence. So that would be a pressure that these animals have not ever experienced.
Yeah.
And, you know, and some people said, well, you know, no, wolves have always killed deer. Yes. But the fact is the last wolf who killed a deer in Colorado was probably 95 years ago or something. So, but the reason I mention that, and once again, you know, I'm glad about the care with which the Colorado project was done, is a lot of the people running that project are very aware of, if you will, the science behind these repatriation, reintroduction, or rewilding.
Yeah.
You are rewilding a habitat when you put an animal like a wolf there who has not been here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, you know, just as an aside, you know, my interests in rewilding have been large scale like that. But my book, Rewilding Our Hearts, is really about personal rewilding,
yes,
where people really connect from, if you will, the inside out. You know, you go out, you enjoy listening to a bird sing or seeing an animal or watching bees pollinate or whoever it is you like to watch.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter, even trees. And you can then respect the fact that these animals are being, how could you say it? That the fate of these animals are in our hands.
Yeah.
The bumper sticker for me is you go out, rewild yourself, and that leads itself into accepting, if you will, that you have a responsibility or an obligation to care for them. Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. I have redirected a lot of anxiety in my brain when I go on walks and stuff from looking at corners and windows and doorways and looking for danger, which my brain is programmed to do, to going, that's a really lovely garden. And I like that tree. And let me tell you why I like that tree. And the small amount of joy from going, this is a tree I like, and this is why. For some reason, doing that regularly kickstarts the observation of, oh, and there's a cute squirrel, and there's a lovely cardinal, and look at that chunky raccoon. And it just allows that connection to take place, I think. When you find the one thing you can connect with, all of a sudden you're exposed to everything else, which is the beauty of ecosystems.
I love the way you just said it, because I always say to people, find something or some, well, I guess say something, tree, although maybe trees are sentient, but find someone, somebody out there about whom you're passionate, and then accept the fact that they're part of a web of nature, a community, and that if you care about their well-being, then you've got to care about the well-being of every other part of their microhabitat or habitat or ecosystem.
Yep.
Absolutely. And more and more people, I know I have to hesitate because I haven't done it quantitatively and that's the science side of me, but more and more people I know are much more attuned to what's going on out there, the odors, the sounds, the sights of nature.
Yeah.
And paying very careful attention to flora as well as fauna.
Yep.
And I just had a friend of mine recently, and I mean, he's a great guy. I know he knows a lot about animals, but he got so excited watching some bees pollinate flowers. And he asked me questions, some of which I could answer, many of which I couldn't. So I just sent them to some books on bees, and he read them.
There you go.
That's, you know, and you know, pollinators are so important in ecosystem.
Yeah.
So, you know, Colorado has a program now, you know, I'm working to increase the well-being and the lives of pollinators, you know. So it's not only the charismatic megafauna like bears and wolves. Yep. And,
oh, yeah. We don't have time for it today, but you and I are going to sit down and talk about fungi and mycorrhizae some point, because that's been learning about that, and it just boggles my mind in such an incredible way. Talk about communication and life on the planets.
And foundational. I mean, you know, E.O. Wilson, who passed away sadly a few years ago, you know, used to say something like, well, if all the walls disappeared, it wouldn't really matter. If all the ants disappeared, the planet would go to hell in a handbasket, which is true.
Yeah.
You know, and so, yeah. And what I like about when people go outside is very few people are ever going to see a wild grizzly or black bear or wolf or coyote, but they're going to see bees and wasps and insects and small mammals like, you know, rats and mice and gerbils and, you know, whoever else is around. And those, the reason I'm spouting on this is because our neighborly animals can really be the gateway species into caring for a wider diversity of non-humans.
100%.
Yeah.
I had someone say, I'd love to see more birds in this neighborhood. So should I plant a bunch of trees? Well, of course, plant some trees. That's wonderful. But also plant native pollinating flowers, because that'll attract the insects, which the birds want to eat. So trees are great for habitat and some food sources, but it's the whole ecosystem that we have to look at to invite the birds into this new development. And then all of a sudden, once you get the insects, you get the birds, you get the mammals, zookery starts taking place, all kinds of amazing things.
I was so pleased when Rewilding Our Hearts came out. I think it was Chicago, but I'm not 100% sure. But this group of people formed a rewilding club, and they put up flowers and other, you know, plants on the roof of their apartment.
Lovely.
And started looking at the birds and the insects who came in, which is exactly what I would like them to do. You don't have to pay $1 million or go do a $25,000 safari somewhere. It's nice if you can do it, and you can do it in a humane, you know, and passionate way. But, and then this one woman became kind of the condominium bird expert.
There's always one.
And actually changed her life.
Wow, that's incredible.
You know, So there's easy ways to build these they're called biophilic cities.
Yes.
You know, a lot of European cities like Amsterdam, for example, you know, and there's an organization called Biophilic Cities.
Yeah.
Cause if you live in the middle of a big city, having been born in one, but also having lived in one for a few years, you could go a long time without seeing a non-human animal of note.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right. Final question. I wanted to stay positive. And it worked out nicely because you made a hopeful comment in your concluding remarks. So I'm going to steal it. Mm-hmm. You mentioned the One Health and One Welfare concepts as signs of progress and hope. I know a bit about these, but I'm wondering if you could explain how those are making a bigger impact than people might know, because I think a lot of it's happening in very high level meetings behind closed doors. And then you see it sort of referenced in a report three days later, but there's not an explanation or anything.
Right. I mean, the UN has a very similar program, for example. Mm-hmm. I mean, the very basic principle there is that our well-being and the well-being of non-humans are really interlaced.
Yeah.
And now there's been so much research it's not a new field, but it's a growing field called conservation psychology, you know, kind of in many ways paralleling the growth of compassionate conservation. So it's showing people how our well-being, you know, say across humans, is really highly related to the well-being of non-humans. Mm-hmm. And it's actually taking off a lot. And, you know, I've said to people, you know, maybe among some of my friends as well as people I meet, you know, as they became aware of the first health, One Health initiative, they just started being a little more friendly, if you will, to non-human animals.
Yeah.
And, you know, some people would say, well, that's great, but wouldn't it be nice if it really came from their heart? And my response is, I don't care where it comes from, as long as the animals are being treated better. However, among some of my friends and people I don't know who have written to me, just hearing about One Health changed their behavior, but then they realized it made them feel better. And then once again, extend this arena or open, you know, have a larger arena of non-humans to who they're more connected.
Yeah.
Feel more connected. So, you know, you just start with that little seed and it'll grow. And I think a lot of people I meet around the world are very concerned about being alienated from nature, number one, which is really easy to do. I mean, and number two, are really concerned about the state of the planet.
Yep.
I know people use the word sustainable, and they use the word, you know, destruction. They use the word violence and destructive for how we treat other species. The point is, and I really believe this, and I'm an optimist, we can't go on living the way we are. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's nothing original with me.
Yeah.
But if we don't treat the fauna and flora and also habitats, the homes of other animals and our own homes where we live better, I don't think we have a very bright future. But I don't think I'll be around to know that. But I do really believe that. So just find out what you like. Find out what you're into. You know, find out what you like. Find out what you're passionate about and save it.
To learn more about Dr. Mark Beckoff, visit his website at markbeckoff.com. Look up his animal emotions blog on psychologytoday.com or find him on Twitter at Mark Beckoff. The Emotional Lives of Animals Revised, a leading scientist explores animal joy, sorrow, and empathy, and why they matter, was published April 9th, 2024, and is now available wherever books are sold and at your local library. Check the show notes in your podcast player or visit defenderradio.com to find these links. I want to thank Mark for his time and all of you for joining us. Until next time, I'm Michael Howie for Defender Radio and the Fur Bears, reminding you to stay informed and stay strong.